From the Brazilian city of Recife, André Ferraz co-founded a startup out of a research project. That was in Local Media, a company that used geo-positioning technology for marketing. Eventually, the retail giant Magazine Luiza bought the startup. But years before that sale, André was already working on using that same technology to solve another huge problem, online security. His new company, Incognia, has gone on to raise a Series A and be present in 200 million devices worldwide. In this episode, André and I talk about André's journey from a computer science researcher to a startup founder, lessons on cap table management, pivoting, exiting, and fundraising, Incognia's creation, and André's view on the future of artificial intelligence. My name is Brian Reckworth, and this is Latitude Podcast. Vamos Latam.
This is great to be on the podcast with you, early Latituder. Also, you're part of the Latitude community. And like when it wasn't even anything, it was just like a few founders connecting and you, I called you in the early days. I was like, hey, I'm building this thing. I'd love you to be part of it. And so you've come a long way since then, but you're already a pretty experienced entrepreneur. And it's really great to have you on the pod, man.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to catch up. There's a lot we can catch up on. Even before you were an entrepreneur, you were a fan of a concept we know as ubiquitous computing. And that basically means that computing is everywhere and seems to us as natural as having electricity, right? So do you think we're already at a point where this concept has turned into a common reality? And how would startups, founders, how should they be reflecting on that and make use of it?
Great first question. So I'd say that we're still quite far, to be honest, because one of the key ideas behind this concept was coined by Mark Weiser, a researcher here from Silicon Valley, is that the most sophisticated technologies are those that disappear. Like they kind of like weave themselves in the everyday things and we don't even notice them at some point. So just like electricity, right? When we turn on like the lights or anything like that, we don't even think about what's going on behind that system. And I have in front of me like so many cables and like weird devices that I'm having to hold all the time that it doesn't feel natural yet, right? But we're heading towards that. Right? We went from like a PC right in front of me to this device, which is way more natural to carry it around. And these things are at some point like getting smaller and smaller and more present in our lives, right? So for example, if you look at a Tesla, right, it's a car, but in the end of the day, it's actually a computer on wheels, right? So as more things become digitalized and we're going to get closer to that vision of ubiquitous computing, I think we will only get there when we get to the point that we don't need to be like pressing any buttons to send a command to a computer. Once we have more natural interfaces, like our voice, for example, we would be getting closer to that vision.
Yeah, I mean, it's some of it's hard to like frame where we are in the cycle of technology, and obviously things speed up really fast if you think of like the evolution of things, like it just the cycles get shorter, right, in all these things. And obviously AI is something that dramatically accelerating things. I want to go back to your earlier days. You come from the Northeast, right? Brazil. I remember running into you at like a startup event. Recife, right?
Recife.
And so I think I saw you at an event like many years ago where I was speaking at an event. There's obviously great universities there, and there's actually a lot of talent that comes out of there. When people think of these startup hubs, they think of, oh, we've got, the Silicon Valley, we've got New York, other satellite regions like Seattle and Austin. And are you a believer that, we're going to see much more decentralization of like these startup hubs? I mean, everyone talks about Brazil. What do you think the kind of the future of Brazil or LATAM in general? Do you think that everything is going to happen in these bigger cities? Do you need to move to a big city to build a company? You moved to the Bay Area, right? You're in the Bay Area. So like you went from Recife and then you ended up landing. What is your belief about these kind of hubs of technology and innovation and startup kind of environments?
Well, I think like now that we got to this point in which we can have a conversation like this, right, in front of a computer. I think it's more viable for these like smaller ecosystems to thrive. For example, like in Recife, there are a lot of engineers that like even before the pandemic were already working for companies overseas and working remotely. So yeah, I'm a true believer that these ecosystems will evolve. I think the key thing is really education at this point, but it obviously depends also a lot on the type of business that is being created, right? So for example, why did I move here to the Bay Area? Because we were building a solution for like fraud prevention, which is a global problem. There are no differences between like the fraudster in like Brazil and here in the US, for example. Like the solution we use to fight these two like types of bad actors is pretty much the same. So we thought of it as a global problem and as a global product. But for example, there are many problems that are unique to specific geographies, right? And we know that in Latin America, there are many things that we don't even see here in the US that are massive market opportunities that founders can tap into. As it becomes more accessible, like things like capital and mentorship and all of that, I think becomes way more viable for these ecosystems to evolve. I'm very excited to see what's going on in Recife, for example, because now there are a number of, for example, venture-backed companies in the area. And like years ago, we were like the first venture-backed company in the city, right? Like people didn't even know what venture capital was. So it's exciting to see how that's evolving.
It's been more than a decade. You went from, you know, computer science research, you transitioned researcher at the university, and then you went into kind of, you know, building. How was that transition? How do we leverage more entrepreneurial kind of young folks that are coming out of these, you know, these schools? Talk a little bit more about what your journey was like, and then some of the mistakes that we can maybe revisit. Because I remember a specific conversation we had in those early days. Maybe we can recap that a little bit and what you learned from that, and what advice you have for other founders.
Yeah, sure. So my life started as a researcher, and it was a great influence for my dad. He's a computer science professor, so had the chance to learn a lot of things even before getting to the university. And yeah, when I started working on that research project, like I started seeing the potential for that to become a real product. And when I got to that point, it was like, okay, if I continue treating this as a research product, this is probably never going to see the light of the day. Like people are not going to use this. The only way to turn this into something that people are actually going to use is if I start looking at it as a company. And then I started like, convincing my, at the time, colleagues and later on my co-founders that was the thing to do. And at the time, everybody was like, oh, I was thinking about like starting an internship and all that stuff. Like, this seemed like a weird idea. And then I just started like applying to many, like, it wasn't even any accelerator program in Brazil at the time. There were like some kind of like educational programs that would like give you grants for like startup ideas out of the university. So I started applying to those things, and we had some early, like very positive responses. And then I was like, hey guys, there's real potential here. Let's build it. And then they decided to jump in and get that started. So the transition was actually quite natural, you know, like we were already building a product, and then we realized that there was no way to actually make it a real thing. It just felt like another step as part of the same process. And it was very, very natural.
I remember that you had a bit of a cap table issue at one point in that early. So you transitioned out of researcher. I think you'd raised a little bit of money. But I remember sitting there with you, and I think I couldn't remember how much of the company you owned or the founders owned, but I want to say it was either 51% or 49%, if I recall correctly. So you were an early stage founder, yet you and the founders didn't have a majority of the company, right? And you were, you know, you hadn't raised a ton of capital. I remember having a conversation with you. In fact, I remember Florian from Loft, Canary Loft, also. I think the three of us were talking about what strategies you could do, because it was kind of a little unfundable at the time, yeah. right? Because you didn't have enough skin in the game. Talk about what you were able to do in order to, I'll use the word claw back, enough equity to make it a more viable business. What was the learning in that process?
Yeah, well, that was tough. So in the early days, right, like we knew that to build the product we wanted to build, we would need like significant amount of money. For us at the time, now that we look at the size of the route, that was quite small. But we were like, we need to raise capital. We don't have any customers yet. Like we were all like 18 years old, from Recife, like the first venture back company in the region. And the best deal we could get was basically a seed round in which the dilution would be 51%. And at the time, to be honest, like we didn't really understand that much, like what did that mean, that we were like giving up control of the company at the seed stage. Few years later, we then realized how bad that was, when we were trying to raise another round and everybody was saying like, your cap table is messed up. You need to fix it. And then we were like, okay, how do you do this? And the reality is that the only thing we really had in terms of leverage in that situation was our time and our work, right? And the effort we were putting into the business. So we were like, okay, if the company is unfundable, the only way to fix it is by fixing this cap table. And the only leverage we have here is the work we're putting in. So the only thing we can say is that if we don't fix the cap table, we're moving out. Right? And that's what we did. Eventually, like after a lot of discussion, we were able to negotiate on a new cap table and we fixed it. And then yeah, after that, the company started growing again, but we spent a lot of time on trying to fix that where we could be focusing on building the business.
So I think there's a good lesson in there because founders oftentimes don't realize how much actual influence they have over those things. And you know, I remember in your case having that conversation, but I was like, what's your motivation, man? Like, why would you keep doing this? Why don't you go start another company? Because, you know, it was a situation where there was kind of a no way out because, you know, you didn't have a way to kind of keep pursuing the dream. And so I think that founders oftentimes don't realize that, but like the founders are building the business. So if there's something that's not right, you need to either fix it or move on, right? And so talk to a handful of founders that as they've gotten heavily diluted over the years, going back and negotiating with your investors an option plan, you hit a couple milestones, you get back some equity. And those are things that I think founders don't know are possible. And especially in like a seed or a series A company where the company is like, it's just dead if the founders are not motivated or operating. You had applied geopositioning for marketing purposes. Give a quick overview of what you were doing. And then you raised significant money. And then if I'm recalling, you made a pivot, right? Your business evolved. Talk a little bit more about what you were building and what the realizations, because it takes significant courage to be able to, especially when you've already invested a bunch of money, time, and then you got to make the call to switch things up. What were the things that you learned that then identified that, okay, if we keep doing this, we're not going to build the company we want. And so we're going to take the pain and we're going to do something different.
Yeah. Well, the interesting part there is that, even though it was a sudden pivot, we were actually kind of preparing for it because like as we started developing the first product, right, the in local media product, the vision was always more related to ubiquitous computing. And what we had to do was basically a very pragmatic thing, which was the ubiquitous computing vision was very far. We knew that the core technology to achieve that would be around location. And during the university project, we have developed a very robust, sophisticated location technology, but we couldn't apply it to what we wanted at the time. So we were just like too early.
Maybe you could just do a quick one liner about in local media and what applied geopositioning for marketing purposes, what that actually
means. Yeah, perfect. So then when we got to that, like, okay, we have this like sophisticated location technology. It's very cool, but we cannot apply to what we want. So the one market opportunity that we identified was, okay, we can apply this to marketing purposes because there are a lot of like physical retailers that are like struggling to compete with e-commerce companies. So maybe we could bring a more like modern solution for them to do marketing. And the idea was you use this location technology so that you can understand and then drive more foot traffic to your stores based on the users that are most likely to go to your store nearby. So we would do things like, for example, analyze like individuals that have visited like stores that were similar to yours. And then if they were passing by, we would send them like a coupon or something like that. And then with the technology, we were able to track how many of those came to your store. Right? And so we were charging our customers for actual like generating foot traffic to them. Like every time there was a new customer inside of their stores, we were going to charge them. And that was an amazing model, like very high margins. It was growing very quickly. Like in 3 years, we were generating over $10 million in revenues, became a profitable business. But even though it was quite successful in the early days, we always saw like some movement from big players like Google and Facebook. Like they were getting closer. They were like starting to launch features that like were looking like our product. And we knew that at some point they would do the same thing. So we were like, okay, if these guys come in, we won't be able to compete. They're just too big, too capitalized. They will bundle this with their existing products and we'll be over. So we need to prepare for that moment. And then we started investing in new products. One of these products was an identity product, a solution where we would use the location tag to fight fraud and do those kind of things. So that was what saved us in the end of the day, because in 2019, right after we raised our Series B for Invoco Media, and we were like hiring and growing the team, we were like over 230 people. Two things happened. First was in November that year, Google and Facebook launched their solutions that were pretty much the same. And then we had a board meeting and it was like, we need to sell this business. We need to sell it. Otherwise we're going to die. The initial reaction was like, oh, there's a lot of value here. The company is still growing a lot. Like this is a healthy business. And you're still spending too much money on like R&D stuff, building other products. You shouldn't be doing that. You should focus on your core. Like, this is going to go wrong. And then the most unexpected thing happened a few months later, which was the pandemic. And we were all about driving foot traffic to physical stores. So our revenues dropped like 95% in a month. And we were like, oh my goodness, what do we do now? And we were lucky to have another product that was being built and said like, okay, this is what we're doing now. Let's get rid of the current product and pivot right away. But that was in the making years ago. And I'm glad that we did the, even though risky thing, but we did it.
So what advice do you have for founders when you feel like the future is not bright, but you've already sunk so much in and maybe you're generating revenue like you are? I mean, it's hard to give up a business that generates $10 million in revenue over, you know, a couple of years or whatever it was and is growing still. That takes a lot of courage to be like, oh yeah, this is working and it's growing and we're just going to kind of walk away from it. I guess the pandemic was an accelerator for you to like make the hard decision, but it sounds like you were already hedging. So like, how should founders be thinking about that?
Yeah, well, that's tricky, right? Because you don't want to be in a position that you're building a startup and you're hedging at the same time, right? Like it's hard to do both at the same time. We only did it because we were like really passionate about the long-term vision for this business. And we saw in the new products like a lot more fit with what we wanted to achieve in the long term. And we saw in the like legacy business as more of like, this is our cash cow. This is going to like finance the new products, but this is not really what we want to do. And we had like clarity internally about that, but it was so difficult to manage the company with that because like for the team members that were working on the like marketing product, they all knew that at some point we would get rid of that. So it was like, that's something I would never recommend to any founder. Like, my recommendation would be like, do just one thing and be focused. We had no choice, because, we knew that the timing was wrong for the other idea. And we were kind of like building a product just to finance that, until the timing was right. So we were quite lucky that we were able to do that and do the transition, quickly. But yeah, that was crazy. Like, if I went back, I probably wouldn't have done it that way.
You ended up selling in local media to Magazine Luiza.
Yeah.
Walk us through that, you know, transaction, how that happened from kind of first meeting to closing the sale. What was that like?
Yeah, that was fast. So everything happened in like 2 or 3 months, the whole process. The one thing that helped a lot was they were our biggest customers for that product. So they knew a lot about the product. They knew that it worked well. And they were aiming for this like Amazon-like vision of like building an ecosystem of solutions for their retailers. And offering a marketing solution for them was one of the key things. So it was like they were already looking for a solution. We were looking for a buyer, and they were our biggest customer at the time. So, I'd say that the decision, that they were going to buy and we were going to sell was very quick. Like, everything happened like probably 2 weeks. And then there was like the legal process and all that stuff. And what we did was like, none of the founders made any money out of that. We just like reinvested 100% of that product. And that was kind of the seed round for Incognia. And yeah, I'm glad we did that, because otherwise it would be really hard to raise like right after like a failure of the legacy business.
So you were able to take that. No one really pocketed any money, but you could finance a little bit of the, pull out any of the tech from the other business, or, I mean, you obviously learned a ton because, you know, there was applicable things, but you're actually able to take in your agreement some of the product development that you had built.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a key part of the deal, was that, we would, maintain the IP on our end. So we sold the assets and we sold the license to our IP, but the location technology actually remained with us, and we used that to build Incognia. So that was fundamental, because I would say that 90% of what makes Incognia work really well is that technology.
So you could leverage the technology you built, and now you're building a cybersecurity business. And so Incognia is born off the back of a wild roller coaster of fixing a cap table, going through a pandemic, which crushed your revenue, to finding a little bit of a rocky landing, but a strong footing on the ground where you could at least have a little bit of cash to seed the next thing. Now you're going out to raise a Series A in the middle of 2022, right? Market cooling down. How are negotiations, and what fundraising advice can you share with other founders?
Yeah.
Because you pulled it off.
We did. It was crazy, because like it was a completely new product. And then on top of that, by the way, I was also moving from Brazil to the US. So it was that on top of all. The early days at Incognia were very crazy, because, very large part of the team actually came from the Inloco experience. So they went through like downsizing and like seeing the company getting crushed and then a pivot. So they were all like terrified, like, okay, we were an ad tech company. Now we are a security business. We don't even know what the product was yet. Let's build it. And then on the other hand, like everyone was so focused on getting this right that we launched the product very quickly. Like in 6 months, it was launched. It's a quite complex product, like to fight fraud for like e-commerce players and banks. We launched it with a mid-sized bank in Brazil. The results, the initial results were amazing. And right after we saw that, we were like, okay, we built the right thing. Let's execute now. And then revenue started growing really quickly. Like in a year, we were already at 2.5 million in ARR, high margins, very good retention, like never lost a customer since then. And then we went out to raise. We went out late. To be honest, I should have gone a little bit earlier, but it was hard to decide at the time. And yeah, we signed the deal like in May 2022. And our lead investor said like, if we'd met like 2 weeks later, we would probably not be closing this deal with you, because the market was cooling down. So, yeah, like another roller coaster. But this one went a lot more, smoothly than the others. And I'd say that first, because of the market, like no one really liked ad tech that much, especially because of the competition with Google and Facebook. So that was one of the key pushbacks we would get in the legacy business. Cybersecurity was a hot thing, so it was different, and we could feel that the reception was much better. I'd say that another thing that helped a lot was being a second time founder and like understanding how to run the process. And by the way, Jason Ye, he taught me a lot about running more tight process with investors, and that made a big difference. So yeah, it was great to raise that round. After that, the company has started to grow very quickly. 12 months later, we quadrupled in size. We're very excited about what's going on now.
That's amazing. I want to dig a little bit more into the growth in a second. Love the Jason Ye shout out. He's going to be a speaker at the Vamos Latam Summit. Awesome. Here on September 28th and 29th. He's going to be leading a fundraising session. The guy is, we brought him on a couple of years ago, led a couple early sessions for Latitude. I don't know if you were in one of those sessions he did back then. Yeah. Yeah, great. So love to see an early kind of Latitude supporter. And then you got a chance to work with him a little bit more, you know, closely. He's definitely worth the price of admission just to go to Vamos Latam Summit. So now you're out executing, you're building, you're growing, you know, you get to 2.5 million ARR, you raise a round. Did you state how much you raised? Is that public information or?
Yeah, it was a $15 million Series A.
So you raise a $15 million Series A, you got a good chunk of change in your pocket, and then you're building a global business from Brazil, moving to the Silicon Valley. And you're selling to, you know, global companies, I take it. One, are we going to see more startups from Brazil, from LATAM, building for the world? And two, if you are building for the world, do you need to be in Silicon Valley?
Yeah, well, I think so. I think we will see more companies building for the world. One thing that I'm seeing is that founders are becoming more ambitious in Brazil and LATAM in general. For example, in my case, right, the first time I came here to Silicon Valley, I think it was like 2012. We were like just getting started. I wanted to come here and get to know more about the culture and understand the ecosystem. And then I had a bunch of conversations with other like engineers. And then I came back and I was like, I can do that stuff. You know, like there's nothing much different with these guys in terms of like their technical knowledge. Like we can build software the same way. So I came back with that impression, and I think starting to see more people realizing that like there are great engineers in Latin America, which was, I think, a misconception that some VCs had in the past. So yeah, I think they're becoming more ambitious. I think we're going to see more companies building globally from Latin America. And in terms of if the founders have to be here in the Bay Area, I think it really depends on the nature of the business. So in our case, our our product is like, it's a software solution we sell to global companies. It's a very technical product, which we sell to other technical people. And in that case, we saw that there was a very high concentration of potential clients here, right? So big marketplaces, big fintech companies, and basically I came here to be close to the customers. But for example, if you are building to a different industry, let's say it's like more focused on financial services, like you want to sell to the large banks, maybe you should go to New York City, right? If you want to work with the biggest banks in the world. If your industry is more like regionalized, right? Well, that wouldn't be a global business anyways. But yeah, like it really depends on where your key customers are. In our case, what we did and what drove us to come here was we realized that pretty much every company in our space was here. All of the leaders were here. And we were like, okay, if we build in Brazil, even if we win there, at some point, a similar company is going to do this in the US and it's going to win in that market. If we're not that company at some point is going to come to Brazil, it's going to crush us, just like Google and Facebook did to and Local Media, right? So we better be that company. And that's why I moved here. But as I said, like, I think it really depends on the nature of the business. There's not a one-size-fits-all solution here.
Walk us through a little bit about the exact product solution, the problem, and kind of how you're tackling it, and then give us some of the highlights on growth and how the business is doing.
Perfect. Yeah, so when it comes to fraud prevention today, most of the companies, they rely on a technology called device fingerprint, right? So basically, it consists of creating a unique identity for a device and understanding if that device is being used by a legitimate user or by a fraudster. Right? So basically, if there is a fraudulent activity coming from that device and it is recognized again, that device should be blocked. So this is how most companies do fraud prevention today. The problem with that approach is that currently, there are a lot of things changing in this ecosystem. Like, for example, the privacy policies from browsers and mobile operating systems are changing very quickly and making it harder to build these identities for these devices. And basically, the fraudsters have also evolved in terms of the tools they use to circumvent these protections. Right? So we saw that there was a need for a more stable way to identify these users uniquely beyond the device. And that's when we decided to combine the concept of device fingerprinting with our location technology. So essentially what we do is we create an identity for a device, but we also track its location behavior to understand its behavioral patterns. So for example, if I'm a fraudster and I'm opening, let's say, fraudulent accounts in a bank, and my device gets flagged, I'll see that, right? I'll see that I'm starting to get blocked by the bank. So the next thing I'm going to do is either resetting that device so it looks like a new device, or I'm going to buy a new phone and do it all over again, right? So this is where the current solutions are not able to detect the fraudulent activity. When we put the location layer on top of that, we're able to see, well, there was an iPhone 12 in this apartment that was committing fraud. And now we see another iPhone 12 that's clean and it's in the same apartment trying to create a new account in that same bank. This must be the same person, right? So we would block that even though we don't have much information about that device. Or if the fraudster gets a new device, right, we're going to see, well, there is a Samsung Galaxy in that same apartment, and it's trying to create an account like 2 days after we just bought that iPhone 12. It must be the same person as well, right? So by combining the location behavior layer with the device identity, we were able to improve the efficiency of the process of fighting fraud very significantly. And by fixing those vulnerabilities, we were able to help our customers reduce fraud by like 98% in many cases. So basically, we got the fraudsters unprepared us for that. Obviously, we need to keep up building more stuff because they will start attacking us at some point. But that's essentially what we do for our customers.
Kind of a cat and mouse game, yeah. Right? Because you learn something and then you institute it, and then people get smarter. And then subscription business is this software as a service? Is it, you know, what's the growth look been like for the last, you know, year or two?
Yeah, it's a consumption based model. So basically, our customers would integrate the technology into their application, and whenever they want to call us for a risk assessment, they're going to pay us a small fee. So they could call us when the user is opening an account or logging into their account, or transferring funds, making payments. So you can call it in any like moment where there is some risk involved. And we would provide you with a risk assessment. So we're going to say like, this is a risky transaction or this is a good transaction. And we're going to say like, why we think that certain deal. Oh, this device is clean. The location is good. Nothing to worry about. So that's how it works. In terms of the growth, we're actually growing quite quickly. I was just doing some benchmarking and I saw that our revenue growth is matching Flex growth, which was, I think, the fastest growing software company in the past few years. So we're very excited to see how quickly revenues are linking up.
That's amazing. And at what point should startups be thinking about cybersecurity in their business? You know, I mean,
yeah.
You got a lot of things. You're just trying to figure out how to get, you know, your products into hands of customers. At what point does that become something that founders should be thinking about?
Yeah, so I'd say that if you're in a like consumer business, I would honestly only worry once you start getting hit and you start having like start losing customers, because building that ahead of time could be quite costly. And you might not know like which solutions to use, because there are so many different approaches to the same problem that you can waste a lot of time trying to build it. So I would be more reactive if I were a consumer business. Like I would just build a product, try to provide the best user experience possible. Once I gain some scale and I become a target, because the thing is, the fraudster would only target me if you're big enough for them to matter, right? So focus on growth, focus on providing good user experience. Once fraud becomes a problem, then my audio recommendation is don't try to build these tools internally, because as you said, it's a cat and mouse game, right? You're going to build the first version, you're going to break it, you have to build a second version. So you have to build a huge team just to maintain it. So I would recommend like working with a partner that can like keep that updated. And I would treat it like that. If you are an enterprise business and you're selling to like large companies, you are certainly going to go through like, and if you're selling software to these companies and the software like interfaces with their internal systems and you're collecting data, then you have to think about cybersecurity early on, because it will be a requirement. So in our case, for example, our first customer right away said, like, you guys need to be SOC 2 certified. And we didn't have the certification. We had to like rush through the process and get it done so we could get our first customer. Right? So enterprise software, certainly cybersecurity should be something to look into early on, but consumer businesses, just be reactive.
No, that makes sense. I got a couple questions before we sign off here, but one kind of very random question, more of just a curiosity for me, and maybe you know the answer is, you know, you've probably seen some of these videos maybe on like TikTok or Instagram where like there's a guy calling a call center and like these are scammers and they're located who knows where internationally, and the guy has all this information about the people. Like how do they get all that information where they're like, they know their name and all this stuff. I'm just curious,
yeah.
If, you know, if someone knows, I figured you'd know.
Those are basically a result of these massive data breaches that we see all the time, right? So for example, we had a couple of years ago here in the US, the Equifax data breach, right? That means that the fraudsters can buy on the deep web, the information about anyone, right? Like, They can buy based on the social security number, and they can filter by the credit score, and they can use that information to either scam you or, for example, open accounts in your name. And then like, if the credit score is good, right, they can ask for a loan, like cash that money. And then like the bank is going to call you like, hey, Ryan, you just took a loan here and you didn't pay while it was me. So yeah, that data is actually for sale right now for pretty much everybody. And the same as happened in Brazil, the same as happened pretty much everywhere in the world. And yeah, that's basically the market behind those data breaches. Like every time we see the news, like, oh, there was data breach of a large telco or large bank or large credit union. And most of the time we don't see the effect of that, but that data has been sold, monetized by fraudsters.
Yeah. I like that you kind of wrap up the episode with a little bit of reflection on, we have to, yeah, I guess, give AI a little airtime here since it's 2023, but future technology, you know, you research and you actually use a lot. AI is a piece of your business. Where are we now in terms of AI being used by and for startups? What gets you excited thinking about the next years of AI at Incognia?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say that these are the early days of AI, because AI has been like being researched for a long time, but it's the early days of AI being applied to everyday things and everyday applications. But I'm very excited about what's going on. I see that the impact of the things that are being launched right now could be as big as the internet and like mobile and cloud computing. I think that there's going to be a lot of opportunities for entrepreneurs, like even without a technical background, to start building like things that are like more advanced in terms of technology. Like I think that's going to like provide more access to people to build more sophisticated stuff. So yeah, I'm super excited about what's going to happen with this. I'm tracking it very closely. I'm applying it to my business, and I'm advocating passionately to everybody. Like if we're not using it, if we're not like at least as a consumer playing with this stuff, you're gonna be left behind, because this will define the next generation of businesses for sure.
Amazing, man. Thanks so much for making the time.
Thank you for listening to Latitude Podcast. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcast for more talks with great founders and investors. I'm your host, Brian Reckworth. Vamos Latam. See you next week.